So, yes, but it's not just my birthday, because it's both my birthdays, the English and the Hebrew, which come out, apparently every 19 years this happens, which those of you can want to now figure out exactly. And if you do it enough times, if you do this around six times at the skula, for Arichas Yomim. Okay, so all of you should have Arichas Yomim with health and happiness. All of us. Amen. Yeah, but they always ignore my birthday because it's a fast day. So, oh, we would have gotten you a cake, but it's a fast day. So. And then 30 years ago, my son was born the day after me. Okay, we'll have one together, but it's always for him. So we know. So, who here was not here last week? Who here was here last week? Who here is not sure if they were here last week? Okay, so everything I'm really doing this week... Yes. Everything I'm doing this week in reality is just a continuation of last week, because we, even though you thought that was the dramatic conclusion last week, but we still need to get to the absolute conclusion. But in order to get there, I have to waste around 55 minutes or so till we get there. So I hope that you'll be along for the ride. But the truth is that if anybody really wants to understand, you have to see the two together. And if you're interested, I wrote an essay which is far too long, where I put them together. So, and I can send it to you if you're interested. Here's the problem, but I actually want to, because we're going to get very specific today, but I actually want to just broaden the canvas a little bit. Jews in yeshiva actually never learned Tanakh, so forget about that. But when rabbis give Divrei Torah, or when we learn, sometimes we get very hyper-focused. A little word, half a word, the trup on the word, or sometimes a whole verse, very rarely a whole chapter. We don't have a great deal of respect for the Archbishop of Canterbury. We don't care much about chapters. Sometimes aliyot, but we never look at it as a whole book. I mean, if I were to say, okay, so what's the book about? It almost sounds the great. What do you mean the book? Bereshit. Well, Bereshit is a book. So what's the book about? What the book is about? Well, it's about creation. Okay, you got to the first two chapters. Bereshit, the beginning. Okay, you got to the first word. So what's the book about? So one of the subtexts of the book, and I think there are many subtexts, but one of the subtexts of the book is it's a book about brothers. It's a book about brothers that don't get along. And that really flows from the very first pair of brothers all the way through the last brothers that we meet. I mean, all the way through this book, we have brothers that don't get along. Now, sometimes the not getting along is a good thing. I know it doesn't sound that way. And sometimes the not getting along is a bad thing. But when I say a good thing, I'll try to describe exactly what I mean by this. In some Hasidic thought, especially Rabbi Nachman, he speaks about birurim. Birurim, the worst way to translate it would be clarifications. But sometimes as you go through, you need to clarify. But clarifying means that maybe you need some kind of either physical or chemical process to take place in order to remove something which is the main versus the unnecessary. So all through life, we see, again, Rabbi Nachman, these birurim, these clarifications taking place. So therefore, the separation that would take place, for example, between Avraham and Lot. So there's, okay, but you'll say those aren't brothers, but they're like brothers. They're close enough to brothers, which makes them a good example. But that's an important separation. Why is it an important separation? Well, this we've discussed before. Because God tells Avraham to leave his house, leave his household, leave his home, leave his father's home. Isn't Lot a part of that father's home? So therefore, even though Lot comes with him, and again, if you remember, there was some intrigue in that. Did he take him? Did he go with him? Who took whom? But at some point, they separate. There's a birur which takes place. So is that a good one or a bad one? Is that a divine command or not a divine command? Or when Avram leaves his brothers, if you will. Well, one of them has passed away, but the other one's still alive. Is the separation over there a good thing or a bad thing? So that's what I'm saying, is that some of the separation which is taking place, we could call it a birur. Now, I'm not going to say that about Cain and Hevel. Right, so Cain and Hevel, that's a bad thing which took place, just for those of you who are morally confused. That's not good. And when God then asks the question, you know, where is your brother? He answers, Ashemerechi Anochi, my brother's keeper. So that may be one of the most important verses in the entire book of Bereshit. Actually, the only problem was he should have ended it with an exclamation point, not a question mark. Hashomer Achi Anochi. I am my brother's keeper. That's really the message of the whole book, is that you're supposed to be your brother's keeper. We can never become a nation if we have no sense of brotherhood, right? It's just so elementary and it's so basic. But then, tragically, we find that missing from the very beginning, from the very first scene, from the very first brothers. And we don't even know what it's about. We don't even know what they're speaking about. And it doesn't make a difference. Oh, because you said that, that's okay. Now I understand. And of course, when in doubt, you can always blame God, because why not? Because you know why they blame God? Because they had no rabbis to blame yet. They would have had a rabbi. They could have blamed their rabbi or their third grade teacher. Oh, look at him. He talked to you, looked at me like this, and that's why I killed him. Okay. Well, what other defenses may have been used? So let's then continue on from there. So it doesn't start off all that well. We have our dysfunctional brotherhood going all the way through. Do you want to say that Ishmael and Yitzchak is a dysfunctional, or is that to be ruled? So as far as Sarah is concerned, it's a birur. We need to separate. We need to send them away. Yitzchak is the opposite. Yitzchak then says, no, we need to somehow bring them back together. Yitzchak, there's this undertone that he then brings the family together. He's the one who brings Hagar back. He's the one who creates some kind of understanding with Ishmael, that Ishmael ends up, we see by the funeral, that he gives priority to Yitzchak, and that they seem to have worked it out, even though we did not realize it. When it comes to Yaakov and Esav, so then, okay, what more do I need to say? That again, from a very early point, we have problems to the point of plotting the murder. Right there. We have the plotting of the murder. And it's actually a little disappointing that he doesn't actually kill him. I'm sorry for that. But it's, why did I say it's disappointing? Because it makes the brothers worse. It makes the brothers, Yosef's brothers, worse than Esav. Because Esav at least had respect for his father. Esav at least said, okay, when my father's dead, doesn't care about his mother, by the way. When he said, when my father is dead, then I'm going to go and I'm going to kill him. So, and that's the Esav that we know of. Although, when we move on in time a little bit, we find that the opposite is true. We find that at some point, Esav backs down. And at some point, Esav says, come, let's join forces, let's go together, let's walk together, let's be one. And, I don't know, are you happy about that or are you disappointed about that? That's not the Esav that we love and fear. That what happened to this Esav? So, do you want the real answer? You want the pshat? You want the drash? What do you prefer? Shot first is because once Yaakov stole the brachot, Yaakov now has been forced to live the life of Esav. And therefore, the Yaakov that Esav loves just looks just like Esav, so therefore it's Esav loving himself and saying, hold it, we can work this out, because it's no longer Yaakov. It's now Yaakov who's like Esav, although Yaakov knows that now he has more challenges in life, because now he has the challenges of Esav, not just his own challenges. That's pshat. At least according to me. You know the difference between pshat and drash? Whatever you say is pshat. Whatever someone else says is drash. That's the difference. So what's the drash? But the drash you have to say for Purim. The drash is that according to the Gemara, Rav Shmuel Yochai says, halacha hi she'esav sonis is Yaakov. It's a halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. So therefore Esav was such a rasha, he wouldn't even keep that halacha. Okay, that's the drash. Okay, you move on from Yaakov and Esav, and then we get to Yaakov's children, and we kind of would have expected, would have hoped, would have thought that this is going to be different. So once again, little repetition here, once again, when Yaakov meets Rachel, he falls in love. And then he actually marries her. I mean, he loves her so much, he marries her twice. There are some husbands like that. Actually, it says that you let him marry your own wife, your ex-wife, let him marry during the 9 days. It says there's no simcha in marrying your own wife. During the 9 days, you have nothing to do, you can marry your ex-wife. Okay. Asar Batavis is a good day. We've established that already. That's not to get married. When it comes now to Rachel and Leah, and Yaakov was sort of fooled or tricked or into this relationship, and so Yaakov should have run away. Yaakov should have said, these are a bunch of crazy people. The father's crazy. The sisters are crazy. Why would I stay in this relationship? This is crazy. But again, what Yaakov may have seen is real, real love between these two sisters. It's an extreme behavior that one will say, hold it, I want my sister embarrassed. Okay, so you marry him. That's not a normal behavior, but it's such an extreme expression of love and devotion and compassion for the other one, that it's very possible that Yaakov looks at this and says, wow, that is unbelievable, because Yaakov, who has not had the love of a brother, looks at the way these two sisters get along and says, you know what, even though this is an insane situation, maybe we can build something out of this. And that may be the starting point for Yaakov's, and Chazal attack Yaakov, recognize that, for Yaakov's perception that he can live with favoritism in his home. He can say that Yosef is my favorite child because Rachel was the favorite wife, and Leah got into this situation knowing that he loved Rachel, and therefore this is all going to work out because everyone, as long as you clarify things in the beginning, listen, I love you more than you, and we're all going to live happily ever after. So that's another fantasy that you think may actually work. But I'm going to say it again. That's how Yaakov is going into this, because he sees how close they are, and he would like to believe that their children then can be that close, and this is going to work out, even though Rachel's the favorite, and then even though Yosef is the favorite. And I don't have to tell you that this did not work out all that well. Then we get to Yosef and the brothers. And Yosef and the brothers, there is this absolute contradiction, which we, I think, can resolve if we stop thinking intellectually. When I say stop thinking intellectually, I don't mean to suspend logic. I just mean to be in touch with emotion. Because emotion is as true as anything else in the world, and maybe even more true. See, there's two contradictory things that the brothers have in their attitude towards Yosef, which just shouldn't work together. On the one hand, if somebody has a dream and comes over to you in the morning and says, I had a dream, and you're going to do this and this and this, do you care? You care? Then I won't tell you about my dream last night. And I'm serious. I mean, and how much do you care? Do you care enough to kill them? I'm being serious. Right. I mean, so somebody has a dream. Somebody has a dream. Who cares? I understand it reflects, but just because they want to do it, that's still not enough. Let me try this again. If somebody who is, I don't know, how can you describe an individual he would have a hard time respecting intellectually? Somebody who is drunk, somebody who is challenged intellectually, who walks by the class, hears me speak, and says, that was like the stupidest talk I've ever heard. So I say, okay. If a great rabbi walks by and says, you know, that was like the stupidest talk I've ever heard, that may take it a different way. And if the drunk guy says, that's the smartest thing I ever heard, am I going to... So what was my competition? So we're either hurt or we feel complimented, depending on who the person is. Listen, the truth, right? The truth is we like all good comments. We do. We all like our positive reinforcement. But it would be far more devastating if it's somebody who we respect says something to us that will be more hurtful. So I want to go back to this. Why are they so troubled about Yosef and the dream? Let me now play this into the larger issue as we move further. Every year when we read this, I'm saying to myself, to the brothers, it's Yosef. Don't you know it's Yosef? What's the matter with you? It's obvious it's Yosef. Have you guys watched any television? It's always the long-lost brother who was, you know, the hated one who's coming back to take... Of course it's Yosef. I mean, I guess the brothers didn't watch enough television growing up. But it's obvious.
Monte Cristo.
I'm saying it's obvious. Really? No, okay. So it's obvious that it's Yosef. So why don't they know this? Because it can't be Yosef. Because Yosef... is inadequate. Yosef's a loser. Nothing's ever going to come from his dreams. But that's why I would say there's a contradiction over here. On the one hand, they're so troubled of what he says because they know deep down inside that he really is superior, that they really will bow down to him, that there really is this, and they want to make sure it doesn't happen. But see, this is really the dynamic then of Sinat Chinam. See, Rav Kook said that the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt and so on and so forth because of Avat Chinam. So Rav Kook is absolutely wrong. I apologize, but it's absolute absurdity. But let me explain to you what he means, or what I think he means, or if he doesn't, what he should mean. What's Avat Chinam? That I'm going to love somebody even though there's no reason. That's the absurdity. Of course there's a reason. Go back to the first brothers in Bereishit. Hashomer Achi Anochi. What's the answer? Yes. Why? Because it's your brother. Another Jew? V'haftarecha kamocha. Should I give you want a whole bunch of other verses as well? Of course you have to love that other person. There's no such thing as Ahavat Chinam. So why does he call it Ahavat Chinam? Because you think that that person is undeserving. Oh. So you think it's undeserving, so we'll say, okay, it's Ahavat Chinam. Why do we call it Sinat Chinam? It's never Sinat Chinam. You always think you have a reason. Yes? You always think you have a really good reason. So why do we call it Sinat Chinam? Because it's disproportionate. It's disproportionate. The reason that you think is not really a good enough reason. The truth is, this is God's value judgment. What you were guilty of is Sinat Chinam. It's not a good enough reason. It is not a good enough reason for hatred, for prolonged hatred. What the brothers have towards Yosef is Sinat Chinam. You're going to say, but what are you talking about? He did this, and he did this, and he did this, and he did this, and it's Sinat Chinam. So the truth is that our Sinat is Chinam all the time, even though we think it's always justified, and Ahava is never really Chinam, but we're twisted. So we think our Sinat has a great reason, and therefore our Ahava ends up being B'chinam. Okay, if that helps you in your motivation, then wonderful. But realize it's just not true. Why? Go back to the beginning of Bereishit. Hashem Erechi Enochi? Yes. But he? Yes. But no. That's just the reality. So now, as I said, we're moving towards this end with Yosef and his brothers, and there is these two contradictory gestures which are taking place. On the one hand, they've completely devalued him. By the way, that's part of Sinat Chinam. Once you hate him, I hate him because he's a loser. But he's not really a loser. But once you hate him, he must be a loser. And that's why they can never figure out that it's Yosef. Because Yosef, how can Yosef be here? Yosef is a loser. Yosef can't be. How could it be that his dreams come true? But that's what bothered them from the very beginning. So in your mind, once you hate someone, then you devalue them as well. Now that you've devalued them, so they're meaningless and they have no power, they have no capability whatsoever. So Sinat Chinam now we can define as looking at somebody and not appreciating their greatness. Sinat Chinam. You don't see who they are. You've devalued them. That's it. That's exactly the point. You have devalued them completely, and that's part of the Sinat Chinam. Now, let's go back to our Yosef story. So we have our attempted murder, plot of murder, discussing murder. It's on the table. And they end up deciding instead in two stages. One is, let's not murder him. Let's just put him in the pit and let more of a natural process take place. But he would die. Even though Reuven doesn't mean for that to happen, that does not work out all that well anyway. And then we have the actual sale taking place. After the sale, they each move on in their different directions, and the brothers, do they ever think about him again? Does he ever come up in there? Echad, einenu. He's not here anymore. Where is he? Einenu. We have no idea what they're thinking. We have no idea what's going on. We're particularly upset with Yehuda. Yes? Why are we particularly upset with Yehuda? Because Yehuda lost a son and buried a son, and he's the one who should turn over to his father and say, I know what it's like to lose a child, and your child's not dead. That's what he should have done. If I were writing the text, I would definitely do an edit there. And when he loses a second son, he should certainly go over to his father and have some kind of a confession. He can never do that. He can't do that. And we never do know if Yaakov finds out about the sale. Now, last week was dramatic, because last week, you'll never guess, that guy who asked them about their father, right? Or actually they volunteer, but who's very interested in their father, very interested in their brother, that guy who they keep bowing down to, guess what? It was Yosef. Were any of you surprised? Okay, neither was I, but could be because I read it last year, but no. Because we knew this was going to happen. From the dreams are true. The dreams do come true. And don't bother me, by the way, tell me it was 11 and not 10, and the mother and not the father. I don't care. The dreams came true. The dreams of economic power and the dreams of political power, those dreams came true. Part of the reason they came true is because Yosef made them come true. And maybe that bothers us, maybe not. But that leads us up to where we are today. When I say today, where we start, Vayechi. We start Vayechi, Yaakov has come down to Egypt, and he lives in Egypt for 17 years. Which means Yaakov spends a total of 34 years with Yosef, the first 17 years of his life. They're separated for 22 years, and now they spend another 17 years together. Okay, so there's some type of, those of you who like math, for some reason you may be happy, I don't know why, but you have 17 and 17. Over those 17 years, Yosef apparently is a good son. Yosef is a powerful man. Yosef is, again, arguably the most powerful man in Egypt. He's pulling the strings. Paro can take the day off, the week off. He's got his harems to deal with. It's a lot of responsibility. And he doesn't have to deal with things like the economy because he's got Yosef. Yaakov dies. Beforehand, he makes Yosef swear that he will bury him in the land of Israel. And one thing, which again, I'm not sure how much I went into last week. I think I did a little bit. there's a difference between Yaakov's dreams and Yosef's dreams, or Yaakov's vision and Yosef's dreams. Yosef's dreams are all self-centered. Yosef's dreams are all about what's going to go on in Egypt. Yosef's dreams are all about the next 5 years, but we're 17 years down the line. Yaakov's dreams or concerns or considerations were long-term. They were about Jewish history. They were about the Brit Bein HaBetarim. They were about hundreds of years. Yosef's and Yaakov's dreams are completely different because Yaakov is aware that this is going to be a very long time. This is the next chapter of Jewish history. We're in the midst of an exile. They come back from the funeral, and now we realize that even though for the last 17 years they lived together in peace and harmony, something really bad happens. Source 1. V'yashav Yosef Mitzrayim ahu v'echav v'chol olim ito l'gvorot aviv v'acharei kvorot aviv. And Yosef returns from Egypt, who and his brothers, I mean, he's the star. He and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father after they buried their father. So they're back home, apparently. Tetvav, Vayir'u Ache Yosef Kimet Avihim. And that's a bizarre formulation. They see, Vayir'u Ache Yosef, the brothers of Yosef see, Kimet Avihim. They see that their father has died. What do you mean they see? You just buried him. Vayomru, and they say, Lu yistamenu Yosef. Now the word Lu over here is a little more difficult than we may think. Rashi gives a bunch of interpretations, but let's just say with Rashi's conclusion, perhaps, Lu yistamenu Yosef. Perhaps Yosef hates us. Vaheshiv yashiv lanu et kol Rashi gamalnu oto, and he is going to pay us back for everything we've done to him. Now there's something tragic right there. That means 17 years have gone by, and there has been no real reconciliation. There has been a detente. There has been a proper behavior. How are you? Fine. How are you? And why don't you come over on Sunday? Very good. But over here we realize that all the gestures that were done are questioned by the brothers. They're questioning now 17 years of Yosef's, you want to call it friendship? You want to call it the relationship? They're questioning 17 years of the relationship. That's a very difficult question. And then they say something which the rabbis don't know what to do with. Vayitzavu el Yosef lemor. They command Yosef saying, Avicha tzivolef neimon tolemor. Your father commanded before. Who are they to command him? So they're quoting Yaakov, and they're saying, Yaakov commanded. Kol tamru li Yosef. Thus you should tell Yosef, Anosono fesha achecha v'chatatam, ki rag melucha. Where they have Yaakov saying, yeah, I know what they did to you. Let bygones be bygones. Forget about it and forgive them. Forgive and forget. It's healthier to let go. Let's just move on from this. Now, the one thing which is remarkable about this verse, it tells us something that we never knew. And that is, did Yaakov know about this? This claims that he did. Now, we also realize there are some problems with this. First problem is, did Yaakov know about this? Because whose interest was it to tell? Yosef, it's not in his interest to tell anybody what happened, because that goes against his whole who he is and leader, knowing, well, I was once a slave and so on. And the brothers certainly have no interest to say it, unless they'll claim that they were so scared that they had to tell him right before they died. But where was Yosef at the time? Moreover, Yaakov has a number of conversations with Yosef before he dies in this week's parasha. There's probably three different opportunities he would have had. He could have called him aside and say, listen, don't take revenge against them. You don't tell the brothers to tell him don't take revenge. You tell Yosef not to take revenge, which is why the rabbis are very cynical about this, and they assume the brothers are lying. You're allowed to lie for the sake of peace. So this example would lie because they think it's going to save their lives, because they think they're going to die. How do I know they think they're going to die? Continuation. V'yef Yosef v'debar me'lev. Yosef breaks down and cries. That's within his character. Yosef cries a lot. And they went and they bowed down once again. We are here, take us as slaves. You only offer yourself as a slave if you're afraid someone's going to kill you. Or worse, torture, whatever. They're frightened that Yosef's about to get his pound of flesh, and everything he's done till now was just child's play compared to what's going to happen to them, and therefore they just offer themselves as slavery. You want to get mystical and say things it doesn't say. You can say that the brothers couldn't wait for the slavery in Egypt to begin. Come, make us slaves. Let's start the slavery. But you all know that's not pshat, right? Okay, good. They're frightened. And that's just part of this. This is another chapter in this tragedy, that after all this time, still nothing has changed. And that's why Yosef cries. Nothing has changed. The various commentaries that we have in 2, 3, and 4 over here, they all play with this Lo Yistameinu Yosef, and what exactly does this mean? The Maharal in Source 3 plays with the idea, well, maybe Yosef still invited them, but just doesn't invite them as often. I thought that was great. Well, see, they don't like us anymore. Why? Well, they used to invite us every 3 weeks, and now it's only every 6 weeks. Yeah, they don't like us anymore. So I thought that was great. I don't know who didn't invite the Maharal over for Friday night, but he touches that. Let's look at a little bit in Source 3. Umishmeitu bevlo kirvu. Now, the Maharal is what they call a super commentary. He's commentary on Rashi. Rashi said that when Yaakov was alive, then all the brothers would get together. Yosef would open up the palace for family reunions, and everyone would come. And once Yaakov dies, he no longer invites them. So that's what Rashi said, and that's what scares them. And therefore the morale says, Mishmeit Avav lo kirvu, he didn't invite them anymore. Pirishki kodum chenaya mekarev otam yoterim min ashiur shirui. Yosef was exaggerated in his kindness when Yaakov was alive. It's also interesting. You say, what do you mean exaggerated? Every day, 3 meals a day, everything you want. And my house is your house, right? Anything. And so they said, no, it was an exaggerated sense. So this is the morale's first suggestion. And then he just goes on to a normal sense. Why? Because it's Yosef HaTzadik, and whoever wants to blame Yosef for anything. V'akshav lo kirvul kolkach. Aval ein lefarsht lo kirvan klal. De'ech yitachen shlo yeh Yosef HaTzadik. Mikarev et achiv. How can you say Yosef would ever be the one to not be nice to his brothers? I think there's something deeper over here, but let's leave that to the point. The next line he says, V'od yesh lomash lo kirvan klal. On the other hand, maybe he never invited them. So the Maharal is willing to go both ways, but he is troubled. He is troubled by this possibility to say, did Yosef really do that? The Bechor Shor, which I'm not going to read, also plays with the emotions. That they're troubled that Yosef has, echad, you know, he has this in his heart, and they just want it to come out already. Because maybe they think it's not healthy for him emotionally, but he goes much more to the emotion of hatred. The Chizkuni quotes a medrash from the Tanchuma, which is geographically improbable. I didn't say impossible, just improbable. It's source number 5, Vayomu Luis Domeni Yosef, Kishashav Mikfurat Aviv, right, that was the verse said. They came back. Actually, if you read the verse carefully, what did the verse say? Vayashav Yosef Mitzrayma. And then Vayiru Ache Yosef. So according to them, where are they at this point? They're in Egypt now. So if you look at the Chizkuni, he says, Vayimu Luis Domain Yosef. Why? Ki kishav mikfurat aviv avar al bor shehishlichuhu achiv uberech alav shasali nisim b'makom hazen. V'hem shamu al ken yiru pendit chadesh alav kol harash asula. Then on the way back, they stop by the boar, and Yosef looks into the boar and says, Baruch atah Hashem lakim mechalam sha'asa nisim b'makom hazeh. And they got very scared. Now, why did I say this is geographically improbable? Here's our tour guide, yes. It's up north. Where's Dotan? Jenin. Jenin. Dotan is Jenin. Not a good place. They, remember, Yaakov sends from Chevron, he sends them to Shechem, he thinks about Shechem, but he gets to Shechem, they're not there, and this anonymous man sends him to Dotan, and Dotan is further north. So that's why I said it's geographically improbable, unless I guess they had the right Israeli cab driver. Sure, this is a shortcut. Kvishesh, this is shorter. We're gonna get there. Okay, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say such things. That's not nice. I take that back. It's most likely the area near Jenin. Yeah, it's the highway. It's the highway. It's the highway. That's where they travel. That's why the people are coming by. So, I mean, it's interesting because where did this midrash come from? Vayir'u, this visual. They see something. They see. So what did they see? They see his hatred. How do you see his hatred? Because he stopped back to take a look. See, it's interesting. And this goes back to what we considered last week. For Yosef, this was the best thing that ever happened to him. I know this is hard for us. For Yosef, the whole thing was the best. This was the best thing that ever happened to him. Because if he never thrown into that pit, he never would have been taken out. He never would have gone to Egypt. He never would have been in charge. His dreams never would have come true. Which means, as far as Yosef is concerned, he could say, you know, I became a wealthy man because of this. I bought my lottery ticket because of this. Because I would. Meaning, as far as Yosef is concerned, and this is what the brothers can't get to. But do you remember the whole speech that we analyzed last week? Yes? Only if you were here. If you're not here, then... If you look at... They commanded. Who were they to command? So Rashi, in Source 9, towards the end writes, where it's bolded, B'nei Bilha. Shri Regilin Etzlo, Shinema Vuhu Nar B'nei Bilha. So it's going all the way back to his youth, and he was closest with the children of Bilha, more so than Binyamin. And Bilha was, again, go back to the relationship. The relationship is Bilha is the servant of his mother. These are his mother's servants' children. And isn't that interesting that Yosef feels closest with them because the relationship there is more clarified than it is by anyone else. And they're the ones who come over to Yosef and they tell him. According to the Midrash in 10, the Seichel Tov, it's very close, but it says, Vayitzavu tzivu leBilha, the one who raised him, his stepmother. Bilha was the one who came and said, this is what Yaakov said. So that's also a little bit surprising. And all 11, 12, and 13, all 11 and 12, it goes back and forth between was it Bilha or was it the children of Bilha, but either one is interesting. The Emek Dover, the Netziv 13, claims Yaakov did say it, and then he found a pasuk where he thinks Yaakov said it. You can decide for yourselves if it really says this or not. Avicha tziva lefnei moto, hu tamua, shor Yosef lo zaza yado mi'aviv b'shat moto. Yosef was there the whole time before he died. What do you mean he told him? Ve'ech tziva hu lo yada. How could it possibly be that he commanded him and Yosef didn't know about this? V'nira shehiskilu lehavino asher b'masha amr bebirkat Yosef v'yefazu zar'ei yadav. The part of what Yaakov says to him, people hated him, people shot arrows at him. He, on the other hand, held back his hand and did not shoot any arrows in return. Many of the commentaries take this as certainly the second part. He was attacked, that's one episode in his life, and the other episode of his life is Eshet Potiphar, that he would not be seduced, and therefore this becomes a sexual illusion, that he did not shoot any arrows at her, as it were. But the Netziv is reading this now, that these two verses go together. People hated him, and they shot their arrows at him, but he would not shoot back. And therefore Yaakov is praising Yosef for his lack of hatred or reciprocity towards the brothers, and therefore the Netziv understands, yeah, Yaakov said it. That was the bracha he gave you. And they're coming back and saying, did he hear what he said to you? He's praising you for not taking revenge, and therefore your father commanded not to take revenge. So the conclusion is the Netziv is brilliant. Whether this is, again, pshat, I don't know, but it's certainly intriguing, because we've all seen that verse, and none of us ever suspected that that's what it said. Look at the Baal HaTurim in 18. Vayishba Yosef et Bnei Yisrael. He made them swear they're going to take him, they will remove his remains. Velo ishbia levanov lefisha amur lehem. Vishchem lakachtem oti, vishama tachziru oti. It's an unbelievable point. Well, Yaakov, I mean, we know that Yosef in the end is buried in Shechem. So according to this, Yosef turns to his brothers, and this is also based upon the Midrash. Yosef turns to his brothers and he says to him, you kidnapped me from Shechem. The only moral thing to do is to return me to Shechem. You have a moral obligation to bring me back to the place that you took me from. And therefore he doesn't turn to his own children and say, listen, make sure that when we leave, he turns to them. Now I want to back up a second and just to identify why the brothers are still so upset with him. And then we have to get to our last 5 minutes, our resolution. Go back to source number one. Yosef cried. They offered to be slaves. We're up to Pasuk Yud Tet. Remember last week I said we have three possibilities. One possibility is revenge, and one possibility is equality and brotherhood, and the third possibility is peace on my terms. And what are Yosef's terms? Yosef's terms are, I'm in charge, and you're not. You bow down to me, my dreams come true, I have political power, I have economic power, I support you, But this is what I call the self-fulfilling prophecy. It's economic and it's political. Oh, the three possibilities would be revenge or complete brotherhood and equality. Okay. The third possibility is, of course, what Yosef chose all the way back then. And in a sense, that was my point last week, that Yosef makes the decision that the relationship will be according to the dreams that he had. They will continue to bow down to him. He will support them. Yosef doesn't let his brothers go and meet Paro. Remember, he brings five of them and he says, make sure you say that you want that you're shepherds. One of the commentaries points out, the weakest ones that he points out, is that Paro would have been excited. What? I can have 12 Yosefs working for me? I had one Yosef, we took over the whole Middle East. I got 12 of them? You know. So he said, no, make sure you tell them that you're shepherds. And he doesn't want them to have jobs. By the way, do you realize that? He doesn't want them to have power. Now, you can read this in a good way or in a bad way. How do you read it in the good way? Oh, you guys get to learn in Kollel the rest of your lives. How do you read it in a bad way? You don't get to produce. You don't get to do something productive. You don't get to have a position of power. You don't get real importance. So now, is Yosef doing that for them, or is he doing that for him? So that I think is very, very important. That becomes a key question over here. Now, that was all Yosef's speech when he met them, when he reveals himself. I'm Yosef. You think you sold me. You didn't sell me. This is an act of God. God has made me powerful. There's going to be more famine. I will take care of you. Everything's okay. Everything is good. You thought it's bad. It's really good. Look what God did. And they're listening and saying, okay, he doesn't choose revenge, but he doesn't choose brotherhood either. So now look at the continuation of his response over here, because where are we? We're right back to where we started. They're still afraid of choice number one. They're still afraid that the revenge is coming. Why? Because they just don't believe that this is an authentic behavior. They don't understand the extent that Yosef has to make sure the dreams come true. Yeah. So let's now look at Yosef's response. Pasuk Yutet. But Yomaleim Yosef, Al Tiro, Ki Atachet Elokim Ani, am I God? Vatem Chashavtem Alai Ra'ah, you want to do something bad, or you thought of me bad. Some commentators read it that way. Atem Chashavtem Alai Ra'ah, Elokim Chashva L'tova, L'man Asei Kayom Azelach Yehoram Rav. You try to do something bad to me, and look how good all this worked out. Do you realize Yosef is giving the same speech again? V'atem al tiro, anochi al kalkel etchem v'tabchem. Don't worry, I'll keep on feeding you. So what does Yosef do? He takes plan C all over again. And what does he do? He continues this relationship where they will have feelings of inadequacy. They will have these feelings that they owe him. They have these feelings that he's in charge, and that's exactly what he wants. And that goes on towards the end of his life, and therefore our book ends as a complete and absolute failure, and brothers never do get together. Except, let's go towards the end then. How do these psukim, one second, what happens right after that, after he tells them this? Let's continue reading. We're still in source number one. Let's continue reading. V'yedaber al libam. Nonetheless, he tries to convince them that this is really a good thing. Pasuk of bed. V'yeshav Yosef b'mitzrayim hu v'et aviv. That's very funny. They just now returned to Egypt. So when did all this take place? It said they returned before. We started the section they returned. So why are they returning again? So it makes it sound like they were on their way to return, and that's when all of this discussion took place, before they even get back there. So now you can just now create a whole other narrative. Maybe even they're on the way back and they're even imagining that if he does not speak nicely to us, we're not going back. We're going to run away. I don't know what we're going to do, but we're not going back. V'yoshev Yosef b'mitzrayim hu uveit aviv v'yichi Yosef me'ev esr shenim, which means that this relationship then goes on from the age of 39 to the age of 110, and Yosef takes care of his brothers from 39 to 110. How long? 71 years Yosef is taking care, feeding them, giving them three meals a day. And how do they feel during this whole time? Vayar Yosef le'Ephraim b'nei Shleishim, gam b'nei Machir ben Benashi yudul b'kei Yosef. Because Yosef doesn't want them to work. Yosef wants to take care of them. I'm reading what it says. Yosef says, this is when Yaakov dies, it's 17 years later. And what does he say? Anochi achakel etchem. I will provide you with food. I'm taking care of you. Yosef never lets them have jobs. Is this like the husband who won't let his wife work? Yosef wants the power. He's not letting them be productive. Why? Because he needs to provide. Why? Because the dreams have to come true. Now, when all this has happened, I just want to read the next verse. I mean, we just now read it. What did it say? Vayar Yosef le'Ephraim b'nei Shleishim, gam b'nei Machir ben Menashe yudul b'kei Yosef. Yosef then sees grandchildren, great-grandchildren. So Rav Lichtenstein had an interesting comment on this. He says that after Yosef comes to this realization that his relationship with his brothers is never going to work out, so he realizes that the lateral family relationships won't work, so he works on the horizontal relationship. He works on his children and his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren, and he invests in them because there is no relationship when it comes to his brothers. There's distrust, and his brothers, after all these years, still think that he's out to get them. And therefore, Rav Lichtenstein saw Pasuk Kaf Gimel as a response to the conversation that just now took place before. But I want to read the end, because we're told now, Yosef, we're told he dies, Vechi Yosef Me'av Esr Shanim, he's 110 years, and he spends his remaining years with his children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. That's what he does. That's who he invests in. But then we have one last conversation. Pasuk Kaf Dalet. Vayomer Yosef El Echav, Anochi Met. Yosef says to his brothers, I'm about to die. V'lokim pakod yifkod etchem, and God is going to remember you. V'la etchem min aretz azot, and he's going to take you out of this land. El aretz asher nishba la'avam Yitzchak Yaakov, and he's going to take you to this land which was promised to Avam Yitzchak and Yaakov. V'yishba Yosef et b'nei Yisrael le'mor, Yosef makes his brothers promise, swear, saying, "Because you've got to etchem, when God remembers you, when God takes you out, ve'litim et atzmotai mizeh, take my remains out as well." So, you know, I think we ignore those two verses, but those two verses are so important and so dramatic that I told you, last 5 minutes, we need to understand what exactly took place. We did not know who Yosef was from the moment he got to a position of power. He dresses nicely. He marries somebody local. He speaks about Egypt. He draws his whole family to come down into Egypt. Again, Yaakov understands this in terms of Jewish history. But does Yosef see Jewish history, or does Yosef only see his own personal history? Yosef tells his father, the message is, 5 more years. He sees 5 more years. Of course, now we all realize that those 5 years have turned into 17 years, and the 17 years turned into 71 years. Time goes by. Now Yosef is on his deathbed, but now a question needs to be asked that we did not know the answer to. Will there be a birur here as well? Will Yosef stay with the Jewish people, or Yosef's going to walk away? The brothers wanted to send him away. They wanted to do the birur. They felt he was bad. They felt he was evil. They felt he was dangerous. They felt he wasn't one of them. And they wanted to send him away. That was the exact point. Send him away. Let's get rid of him. That's the birur. That's what the hatred did. Now the question is, what's Yosef's own self-perception? See, we know how it ends, so it's so simple for us. But don't you realize there's an alternative ending over here that it could have been? That Yosef gets buried in one of the pyramids? And Yosef is treated as the pantheon of leaders of Egypt, and Yosef gets deified together with the other pharaohs, and that Yosef never wants to leave because Yosef is part of Egyptian culture, that Yosef has completely assimilated and he's one of them. That was also a possibility. Did we ever think about that as a possibility? But why? Because we know the way the story ends. But if it wasn't for these two verses, we don't know what's going to happen next. Moreover, how do the brothers look at Yosef? How do they think it's going to end? They see him as just being part of Egypt. He's part of his power structure. He loves the power. That's who he is. And now everything has changed in these last two verses. Because on the one hand, Yosef just now said, he spoke about God, but Yosef always speaks about God. Did you realize the difference of how he just now spoke about God? Every time it's been about him. And now God is going to remember you. That was a shift. There's going to be an exodus, which means he's now buying into the Brit Bein HaBetarim. He's now buying into Yaakov's dream. He's now buying into the prophecies that were received by Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And one of the most important part of those prophecies is the land of Israel. And we never knew how Yosef feels about this. Yaakov, we knew. Yaakov came down, I'm going back home. And now for the first time we realized, Yosef says, I want to go home also. We didn't see that coming. And we could not have predicted this unless you know how the story ends. Because after all of the charades and after all the games and after everything has gone on and all the bowing down, Yosef just now bought into Jewish history, not his own personal history. And Yosef says, I want to be part of Jewish history. Don't leave me here. That's critical. But there's a second point. And the second point is just as important. Second point is Yosef, for the first time in all these years, maybe ever, asked his brothers for a favor. He needs them. the whole time they need him, and he made sure they need him. Those are the rules of the relationship. And now, for the first time, Yosef is vulnerable. He's on his deathbed, and he says, I need you to do me a favor. Do you realize what that does? Do you realize what just now happened? Yosef just now turned to them as equals, as somebody that he needs. Now they became brothers. The tragedy of this relationship is that if Yosef lives 110 years, for 110 of them, there's no brotherhood. That's the tragedy. On the other hand, if you ask Yosef, what would he say? Hashomerachi Anochi. They didn't look after me. I looked after my brothers more than any brother ever looked after his brothers. But you know what? That's also not okay. You also have to let your brother pick up. You have to. Your brother's dignity is also important. Not just that you look after him. It's not just Hashomer Anochi. It depends what the choices are. Hashomer and not kill him. Yes, Hashomer Anochi. I'll protect my brother. But your brother's dignity is also important. And Yosef did not let his brothers have dignity. Yosef's dreams were they're bowing down to him. Yosef's dreams were he's going to take care of them economically. Yosef lives those dreams. Those dreams are absolutely true. And then in his last breath of his life, he turns to them and says, listen, I need you. And all the brothers, the family, everyone he's been taking care of, you need us? That gave them so much dignity. At that, of course we'll take you out. So how does the story continue? Paro forgets Yosef. But the brothers never forget him. Which actually means that Sefer Bereishit had a happy ending, and we didn't realize it. It has a happy ending. Brothers could not get together the entire book until literally the second to last verse. They finally get together. And once we're together, we can be slaves. Once we're together, we can do anything. Once we're together, we can withstand the slavery. And once we're together, we'll march out to Har Sinai and we'll march to the land of Israel. Because in order to create a nation, you first have to have brotherhood. Thank you.